I'm just going with the flow, so.
You're listening to Three Wise Truck Guys from Key Advisors.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Three Wise Truck Guys. This is Keith Ely coming at you from Lawrence, Kansas, where we're going to get a few storms here later this afternoon. With me is Mark Martinsic. Mark, good to see you again.
Thanks, Keith. Good to see you again.
And it's always good to be seen, too.
It is, and particularly at my age. It's good to be seen.
So, Mark, it is April Fool's Day as we record this. Any good April Fool's pranks pulled on you or by you today?
No, it's just me and the wife in the house, so nothing. To be honest with you, I forgot it was April Fool's Day. But maybe when we bring in our special guest, we could do an April Fool's deal. What do you think?
Maybe we can.
He can't hear us right now, so, you know, we'll have to come up with something.
Yeah, and I do remember certain people of our employment pulling certain April Fool's jokes on certain said people over the course of time.
Yes, Keith. Me and Alan Phibbs have pulled a few on you.
Yes, you did.
Not saying you're gullible, but it wasn't that hard to do.
And our other third wise truck guy is on a sabbatical for a couple of months, so John won't be with us. He's actually on a sabbatical, and we wish him well on his couple of months sabbatical and look forward to having him back. We do have a special guest, Mark, before we get into our what's happening, and just it is the craziest shirt I think I've seen on any one of our guests.
Yeah, speaking of April Fool's jokes, that shirt maybe is it, do you think?
Yeah, maybe we should turn this into a video podcast. So.
There you go.
So as always, Mark, we start out with what's happening out there, and since John's not with us today, I'll let you start.
You know, in the past, when we get to this segment, we've talked about the shortage of quality technicians, if not all technicians, and the high cost of training somebody if they're not quality when you hire them, okay? And the fact that in many dealerships, probably most dealerships, demand exceeds capacity due to those things, okay? And yet, I was in a dealership not too long ago where they've had some, they were missing their effective labor rate, their weighted average billing labor rate by almost $40. And this is not unique to this dealership. Typically, we probably see an average of $20 to $25 degraded on that billing rate. And some of that is necessary if we're doing maintenance work like a PM or brake job and it's highly competitive in your market. They tend to discount it and probably should and sell it at a total price, okay? Certainly, we recommend that they compete in those areas. And it, by the way, takes a lesser skilled tech, a little bit easier to find techs to do that kind of work if demand does exceed capacity. But this particular store had a number of negotiated contracts. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners today have negotiated contracts with quote-unquote special customers or a customer with a little fleet of 8 or 10 trucks or more that requests a lower effective labor rate, a lower labor rate billing, okay? In return for anticipated volume, they're assuming, because they have 10 or more trucks, that they're going to get some volume from that customer. And certainly, volume deserves a discount in many industries, okay? questioning them a little bit, okay? They had no standard way of offering a discount, okay? Service manager made the decision on his own, okay? Could not. It took them almost a half a day to pull all the customers and what labor rate they were. They had a negotiated rate. Nobody was managing the rate. When we looked at the volume by customers that had that special rate, it wasn't very impressive for the most part. Okay, there was no standard, no tracking of the volume they got in return. And probably, and I'm I'm guessing here a little bit, but I've been doing this a long time, probably never was a discussion up front about the benefits of doing business at my dealership. The longevity of the company, the number of locations, the amount of money we invest in parts inventory to have the right part the majority of the time for their vehicle, the money that we train, that we spend to train technicians and the software we buy and the special tools that we buy to do that work. We just arbitrarily, a service manager in this case, arbitrarily offered these discounts thinking he could buy it. Remember, demand exceeds capacity. Quality technicians are hard to find. If you're training a technician to be quality, okay, it's very, very, very costly, okay? And there's just no standards. If you contrast that to a dealership that does manage these things, and certainly we teach and have the structure to that and maintain a higher effective labor rate, what they need to realize is every dollar you gain in effective labor rate drops to the bottom line. There's no additional cost. It's sale, it's gross profit, and it's net profit. So building the right structure, building the right rates for the right type of work, training people to sell total job price and talk about benefits is critical. And we have many dealerships that do that and do a very good job with holding 90 to 95% of their door rate. Day in and day out, month in and month out. So, you know, for our listeners, check your effective labor rate. Your DMS system does it, or just add up the labor dollars that you sold and divide it by the labor hours that you produced, and you'll be able to see that billing effective labor rate and start looking at it. Start looking at negotiated rates and other discounts that are offered. And why is it? Because you're just throwing money out the window.
That's it's funny, Mark, you bring that up, because the item I wanted to talk about today, there was actually two. One, I'm going to ask you some questions because you're working on one of these projects. But you know, the other one was this effective labor rate, and also just kind of a what's going on in volume in the market. You know, I heard from one of our customers today that their parts and labor volume was down about 5 to 7% in March, and yet I'm looking at another one that as I look at their numbers for this quarter and for March, they are at a record pace, and not just because of rate, but also because of
total volume. It's been a little hit and miss, particularly in January, but February, the dealers that I'm talking to, okay, started picking back up, and at least they're running historical averages and many above that. I haven't talked to a dealer in the last close to 2 months that had slowed down, but those things do run regionally sometimes, depending what's going on in your region. Yeah. Depending if you're working on work trucks or over-the-road trucks and so on and so forth. But it's something to keep an eye on, okay? Yeah. That's for sure.
What was interesting, though, in their follow-up, and this just came out, that their effective labor rate was right at 90% of door rate. You know, total rate, warranty, internal customer pay. And if they had just been able to bump it one more point up, it equates to $3 million of net profit annually.
Yeah.
Just by that little point.
Yep. Just managing that one thing. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a big deal.
Yeah. You've heard me say it before, but the top of the statement is all about how many hours did you bill and at what rate did you bill it, right? And it sounds easy to manage those things, but obviously there's a lot of structure and training needs to be done to do that, okay? However, it's not brain surgery. It's probably one of the easier things that we do for dealers, help them build that and structure that. So,
And what's interesting then, you know, their part sales are are holding very strong, and they're maintaining a really, really, really strong margin in parts. So, I think, again, I think it's interesting that there's some pockets of the country that apparently are seeing some depressed sales.
Right.
But others that just continue to do outstanding volume. And I'm not sure how much of it's pocket of the country versus the dealer themselves, too. So I'm sure there's some of that.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not just one thing. Never is.
You know, the other thing that I just wanted to comment on, we've got, I think, four of these projects going right now. In fact, I know our guest is doing one of them right now. But Mark, you're doing one, and then Amber's doing one, and of building revised comp plans, and really tying them to things that the people that we're building these for can control. I know you're building it for what, advisors, warranty.
Advisor, foreman, warranty, support personnel, and well, management, the whole management team for a dealership, okay. And converting what they did have, which was not a bad pay plan, but the people didn't understand it. When you pay a service advisor on something as simple as gross profit, which to us, we know the drivers are gross profit. Not always do your frontline people understand that, and they just kind of try and work harder and hope they make something at the end of the month, okay? So we typically tie it to the drivers, the key metrics that drive your KPIs, which obviously are based on your financials. So, but those key metrics that they control every day on every repair order, okay, is what we build them on. So the equation, the result is the same as paying them on gross profit, okay, the advisors, but through the key drivers that drive that.
Right, the things they can see every day and manage to every
right.
day.
Right, things they make decisions on every day,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like effective rate.
Like effective labor rate, okay, like an SRT time, okay, upselling something, just managing the workflow, reducing downtime for their customers, all those things.
Yeah.
Reducing downtime opens up capacity and so forth, okay.
I know Amber's working on one comp plan design for really the whole dealership for the group she's working with, all the way down to admin level and so forth. And she's building off that same, you know, the same concept of control, what pay off of the things you can control that affect what the big numbers are, the gross and the expense and those types of things.
Right.
I know our guest today is working on a outside part sales plan, that revising that based on, you know, not, it's a pretty simple idea, but trying to base it upon what that OPS can control, and also trying to incent on some growth in their markets as well, and customer acquisition and so forth. So, you know, I just find it interesting that that people are. That the comp plan thing never dies. And, trying to build a more simple, effective comp plan tied to things that people can control. And
that they understand. Okay.
Yeah, that they understand. That's right.
Yeah. You know, if you install a new incentive portion to their plan and they don't make it for a couple months and they don't really understand it, it can really damage your culture and your retention percentage of your employees. So.
Well, hey, this month we're going to switch gears. I know we talked last month a little bit about service. We've had used trucks this year. This month, we're going to spend some time on parts.
Parts
yeah,
is parts, right? Anybody can sell a quarter fender.
That's right. But I think the real question is, and the topic for today is, everybody can sell a quarter fender, but why in the world would you need to stock 8 different types of quarter fenders when you've only sold one type of quarter fender?
Exactly.
The other 7 went obsolete.
Exactly. Well, service complains about off-the-shelf availability all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
So, well, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to help you.
Well, even when it's good, they're going to complain about it. But I've seen some dealers where it's not so good too. So,
Mark, tell us. I know you've been around this a long time. What's the importance of obsolescence management in the parts side?
Well, it's frozen capital. It's frozen cash, and it keeps you from having the parts that you need on the shelf. Okay, but you know, from a dealership standpoint, a business management standpoint, it's never good to have frozen capital. Things that aren't going to sell or are going to sell very slowly. Okay, overstock. It takes up space where other parts can be, and it freezes capital that could be purchased for other parts, or maybe some tool that'll make you money in the service department or something. So,
idle capital is never good.
Right.
Well, we're gonna talk to Jeremy Smallwood. Jeremy is our professional advisor, one of our professional advisors in the parts operations. He's our subject matter expert, and I'm gonna let Jeremy tell us a little bit about himself. So, Jeremy Smallwood, welcome to the Three Wise Truck Guys, and thanks for taking the afternoon to visit with us.
Oh, thank you, Keith. I appreciate it. And it is quite an impressive shirt, isn't it?
It is quite an impressive shirt. If impressive is the right term, that is it. So.
You know, Jeremy, if you shaved the beard and just kept the mustache, you would look just like Magnum.
Well, before the meeting, you know, Mr. Mark, you told me that if you were going to sound good, you had to dress good. So I pulled out my best Hawaiian shirt and figured you might like that a little bit.
Well, good to have you, Jeremy. So why don't you, you've been introduced, but tell the audience a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I'm in my 35th year now. Working in the heavy-duty truck industry.
It's amazing. You're only 52.
I know. I started when I was 17 years old. 17 at the dealership. Worked for International, Cummins, Peterbilt. I was a graduate of the ATD Academy back in 2017, also class president. And I've had the privilege of working for Key for almost 2 years now. So I enjoy parts.
We're really glad you're here.
Wow, thank you. Glad to be here. And parts department is what I love. It's what I enjoy. It's what I get into. I just love diving into different situations and different problems and solving them. I love it.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about a couple of the projects that you've been working on, Jeremy? I know you've got, maybe four of them going right now in different stages. If you don't mind, just to bring our audience up to date on some of the things that you're working on right now.
Sure. Specifically, especially we're going to be talking about obsolescence today. I have two particular clients. One is a 10 rooftop client, and they had a $2.8 million obsolescence issue. And then I have another client, which is a 19 rooftop client, and they currently had a $4.2 million obsolescence issue. So between the two of them, obviously, you know, that's a lot of money sitting on a shelf, talking about dead capital. So that was the main problem. That's the reason why they called us, and that's what we went in to try and tackle.
Okay. Mark?
So, Jeremy, you know, with that kind of obsolescence, okay, what's the first thing that you do? How do you tackle that?
So the first thing we realized is traditionally in our industry, and it seems to be this way across the board, your best warehouse guy becomes your driver, your next counter guy. Your best counter guy automatically becomes your next parts manager. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have the skills or the ability. They were just the best man there at the time, so they were promoted. And that's what we see a lot of times when we go into these engagements. And with these two particular clients, they had a lot of good guys. They cared about what they were doing. They just never had any training. So the real key to getting both of these projects off the ground, and it took a few months to do this because we had to establish the basics. We had to establish the six, seven basic things that you need to do in a parts department to manage a parts inventory properly so that you can have inventory integrity. And they just didn't know. So we had to start from the ground up and teach them, and not only teach them, but then we also had to give them the tools to track and hold people accountable to making sure that these things were done and done on a daily basis. So that's where we had to start the project.
So what kind of results did you, or is it too early to tell, what kind of results do you expect?
So with both of these clients, where the first 3 months, again, was a lot of training. Over the last 9 months, for the client with a tin rooftop, we've been able to reduce their inventory, their obsolescence. We've been able to reduce theirs by over $1 million. And for the 19 rooftop client, we've been able to reduce theirs by $1.4 million in about 9 months.
Wow.
So I know that Mark used the term frozen capital earlier. It's one thing, I guess, to reduce the ops. So I'm going to let you talk to us some about how you did that, Jeremy, here in a minute. But one thing that intrigues me, and I certainly remember when teaching it at Dealer Academy, that people would say, well, how do I get rid of the OBSO? And again, I'm going to let you speak to that here in a minute. But to me, the most important question, even maybe more important than how do I get rid of it, is what do I do to stop it and not have it occur again? Can you talk a little bit about, you used the term inventory integrity earlier, maybe that plays into it, maybe it doesn't, but talk to us a little bit about, you know, what are the things that you've done to keep it from happening again as well?
So that's a huge part of the project when we engage. Not only do you have to train the managers on the basics, but it does you no good to get rid of the obsolescence, you know, flush the toilet, so to speak, and clean the system out. Because if you don't do what you need to do on the front side, in a year you're going to be doing the same thing. You're going to be writing off inventory, trying to get rid of obsolescence. So we had to start not only with the basic training, but also what policies and procedures did they have in place? We have to stop the obsolescence from occurring in the first place. So by building these basics in the parts department and by adding policies and procedures into that, for instance, a policy on what do you do if it's a special order non-returnable part? Do you collect cash up front? If it is a non-stock part that you don't want on your shelf and you have to order it, but it is returnable, do you collect a restock fee? Do you collect the money up front? Do you collect freight, not only for the part coming in, but also if you have to return the part, do you collect freight for the return? Is there a specific window that you're allowed to return the parts in? What we noticed with the two clients we're speaking of specifically is even though they may have had one or two of these policies as a company, the majority of people didn't know about them. So we had to not only go back and revamp the policies and procedures, we had to roll them out for the entire company again. Also, when we did that, to go along with that basic training that we gave the managers, we provide a tool. It's called the Daily Track. And that Daily Track has five or six different categories in it. We suit it to the client, depending on what their need is. And by following those five or six things in that Daily Track, you ensure that your obsolescence doesn't grow. You ensure that the policies and procedures are followed, and you have a clear path for accountability to keep these things from happening again.
So, Jeremy, in other podcasts for service specifically, obviously you know I'm going to talk about service, okay? We've had discussions about how you get people to change and how you change the process and how do you ensure that it stays and so forth. And the listeners that listen to us know my views on that. But how do you instill that down to every man? Or do you leave it up to them to do that?
That's the hard part, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, with the parts department, with that Daily Track, the way the Daily Track is set up and the way we teach that, there's a clear line of accountability. So once we have that established, once the managers are comfortable with it, once we've explained the why and the how, now over the course of the next year or so, depending on how long the engagement is we have, now it's constant follow-up with the managers. We have weekly calls with some clients, sometimes it's bi-monthly, sometimes it's in-person visits, but we have to stay on top of it. We have to make sure that accountability is there. We can't just go in and ask them to do it and then walk away because it'll never get done.
And that's the secret, isn't it? Okay, both when we're engaged and after we're done being engaged, for them to have that instilled, that accountability and coaching that has to take place daily sometimes, right?
Yeah, it definitely daily. We were talking at the one client we were at, it's 21 days to create a habit. So they have to do this daily track. They've got to continue on it. And when we teach them that daily track and we teach them the pieces of it that are the accountability piece, then, like you said, we have to keep following up and making sure that they're implementing it, making sure that they're following it, making sure that they're holding their people accountable.
So when you do all of that, what's a sample of the results? Say one of them was $1 million?
Yeah, one of them we reduced the obsolescence by a little over $1 million, and the second one it was a little over $1 million, $1.4 million.
And to Keith's point now, are they tracking less buildup of obsolescence?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know too, Mark. Thank you.
Yes. So the main thing for obsolescence, the main contributor to obsolescence, is non-stock parts. And purely by definition, those are parts we don't want on the shelf. So how do non-stock parts get there? They're ordered for the back counter, and they're not used in the shop. So they return them to the back counter, and he puts them back on the shelf. Customer orders a part, doesn't need it. Counterman puts it back on the shelf. Counter guy, front or back, messes up and orders the wrong part, realizes it's the wrong part, takes it back, puts it on the shelf. That can't happen. There's a process and a procedure for everything in the parts department. We joke all the time that there's no emotions in parts. And it's true. Parts is math, fact, and logic. So when you have those instances, if you get a return from the shop, that return needs to go immediately back to the vendor. It can't just sit on your shelf because in 12 months, it becomes obsolescence because it's a non-stock part. Same way with the customer part. Same way with the part that was ordered in error. There's different policies and procedures according to the OEMs. So what we have to do is, first of all, find out what those policies are, what those return windows are, what the criteria is, and we have to teach that. But there's so many other things that go into it. Another piece of the daily track is doing a regular cycle count and identifying those parts and finding out why these non-stock parts ended up on the shelf in the first place. And not just making an adjustment to the inventory, but finding out why it happened and using that as a teaching moment for whoever made the mistake, whether it was a shipping and receiving error, whether it was a counterman's error, whether it was a service technician who ordered 10 parts because he didn't know what part he needed for the job and only used two of them. Well, maybe the service manager needs to go out and train the technician to diagnose the job properly. Maybe we have a counter guy who's very fresh and very green and doesn't know what to order, so he's ordering excess parts. So when we find these things, not only do we need to correct them, we need to find out why they happened, and we need to teach to that fact.
So wait a minute, okay? Stop right there, Mr. Parts Guy. Okay. Are you trying to tell me that the parts department cares about having the right part for service?
And see, the service guy's getting emotional again.
There you go.
And have emotions in parts. The parts guy cares very much about what's on the shelf.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about inventory integrity, you know, having the right part on the right shelf, and the right quantity at the right time and for the right price. And whether it's a service customer or whether it's a counter customer, if I don't have the part when that customer needs it, I lose control of that sale. And what I mean by that is when a customer comes in or a shop customer comes in and I have the part they need, it's on the counter in front of them. They're not walking away. I control the sale. I control my markup on that sale. The minute I don't have that part, now the customer is in complete control of the sale. Now the customer has options. I may be able to get that part later this afternoon. He can pick up his phone and call my competitor down the street and see if they have it in stock. Maybe they have it for a better price. Maybe they don't charge freight. Maybe they can get it quicker than I can. Now he has a negotiating tool, and I want to take that away from them. I want to have the right part on the right shelf at the right quantity at the right time and at the right price. Because if I do, I win every time.
So I think you call that the five R's, correct, Jeremy? Just like the rule of twos on the service side.
Yes, sir.
So, Jeremy, you mentioned inventory integrity, and I'm imagining that this is all the structure that's in place, along with knowing that your inventory is correct, okay, along with having some sort of system or structure to control what is stocking, when the phase in, when the phase out, and those kinds of things. Without getting too deep here, okay, can you explain to us a little bit, when you say inventory integrity, the kind of things you're looking at or trying to fix?
Yeah, so with the inventory integrity, one of the main things we want to make sure of is that the parts we show on the shelf are actually there. It's so important, and most people don't realize it, but the acceptable error rate is less than 2%. So that means that if 100 times you go to a shelf, less than twice, on 100 different times, less than twice, that quantity is going to be wrong, or the part's not going to be there, or it's going to be in the wrong bin. So when we talked about the daily track earlier, one of the main things on a daily track is doing a daily cycle count, making sure those parts are where they're supposed to be and the quantity that they're supposed to be at. But it's imperative to have those parts. You know, when we talk about shop throughput, if my account is wrong or my quantities are wrong, how often does that shut a job down for a day or worse? You know, maybe these parts are now backordered. I showed 10, but I've only got 2. You know, we told the customer we've got 10. The shop pulls the truck in, tears it down. We go to pull it. There's only 2 on the shelf.
Yeah, and we need 6 to do the job. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So inventory integrity is just, it's vital to everything we do in a parts department. You have to be able to trust your inventory. And I always bring up the example of, we've all seen and heard at the counter, a counter guy picks up the phone and says, yeah, I show 4 of them. Let me go check and make sure I've got them. And he puts the phone down. He never puts the phone on hold. It's just sitting on the counter. So the person on the other end of the phone hears everything going on in the whole building. And he's usually gone for about 10 minutes because he can't find them. So he goes to get his manager, and now him and the manager are back there looking for him. They can't find him. And meanwhile, the phone's ringing off the hook. Where if he could confidently pick that phone up and say, I show 1, I'll send it out to you this morning. Do you want to come get it or do you want me to deliver it? Boom, hang up the phone, grab the next call. How confident would your counter guys feel? How excited would they be to come to work knowing that they didn't have to spend half the day looking for parts because they were there? Because you had done what you needed to do up front. You'd followed policy and procedure. You ensured the inventory accuracy. Now all you have to worry about is selling the parts. Makes it easy.
That sounds like that's really a plus to get counter person buy-in to the program as well. Because they'll do their job a lot more efficiently, right?
Absolutely.
And if they're paid a commission, they're going to make more money as well. So. And the dealership makes more, and the customer's happy, so it sounds like a win-win-win to me.
So, Jeremy, I'm going to come back to one thing you mentioned earlier about what causes this obsolescence. And you used the term non-stock, and you said by definition it just shouldn't be on the shelf. Could you dig a little deeper into what you mean, what we mean by non-stock, And then I guess also, you know, to maybe close the loop on that statement of by definition, it means that, it shouldn't be on the shelf, and why that's such an important thing in your mind.
Sure, not a problem. So the one statistic that I always go to immediately, you know, especially when we're talking about stock or non-stock, when you sell a part one time, you only have about a 34-35% chance of selling that part again. When you sell it twice, it raises up to about a 65-66% chance of selling it again. And once you sell that part for the third time, you have a 95% chance of selling it again.
Okay.
So obviously, if we think about going to Vegas and gambling, are you taking the table with 35% odds, 66% odds, or 95% odds that you're going to win?
Right.
So that kind of sets the stage for what we call stocking criteria. And most of the companies we see out there, most standards we see, it's usually something 3-12 or 9-12. One variation of those two. So in other words, you sell three or have three hits, picks, or demands in a 12-month period or a 9-month period, depending on how aggressive you want to get. But that's usually what constitutes a part being a stocking item.
Okay.
If you had only sold, you mentioned the quarter fenders and wanting to have 10 of them on the shelf. Well, if you only sell one quarter fender, and it's the same quarter fender, and it's the one you sell all the time, why would you stock nine others of a different variation?
Right.
And I love the response that I get, and sorry, Mark, it's usually from a service guy, when they say, if I don't have it, I can't sell it. Well, that kind of logic creates all kinds of frozen capital.
Right.
And useless.
Right. I've seen dealers that do that, okay? If they sell once, they put it in stock. We might sell more of these. Okay.
So I want to come back to the non-stock piece, so Jeremy, about how we end up with those non-stock parts on the shelf that have eventually become this obsolete part. How do we end up with those parts?
So let me run you through a couple of different scenarios. The first one is I'm the parts manager, and my sales rep came in, and he showed me the neatest line of chrome I've ever seen.
Okay.
It's so neat. Everybody's going to love this. I need to stock it because we're going to sell a ton of it. You've never sold it before. You haven't talked to your customers. You have no idea what the market's going to hold. But yet you order this chrome because it was really cool and you liked it. So now 12 months later, here you have all these nice, pretty racks of chrome sitting in your showroom that you haven't sold a piece of yet.
Okay.
Another thing that happens, you know, a service manager comes in and says, we just did this repair on this truck. This customer has five trucks just like this. I need you to get four more of these because I know we're going to do the other four trucks eventually. Well, 12 months later, here's the four parts sitting on the shelf because the other four trucks never broke down.
Okay.
Your salesman's out on the road and the customer says, if you stock this for me, I'll buy it. Salesman orders it in, has it on the shelf, customer never buys it. We order a part in correctly. Instead of following policy and procedure, returning it to the vendor or to the OEM, we put it on the shelf. We order a special order part for a customer, the customer doesn't come to pick it up, or the shop doesn't use that part on the vehicle, they return it to the back counter guy, customer doesn't pick the part up, so eventually the front counter guy puts that part back on the shelf. 12 months later, there they sit.
Okay.
Well, they haven't met the stocking criteria to be a stocking item. They don't have the sales history to be a stocking item, but yet we've brought them in under these various ways, and there's a lot more, but those were some of the most glaring ones that seem to recur every time. And when we do those things, it's a non-stock part sitting on a shelf, and it automatically rolls into obsolescence 12 months.
So are you saying then that we need to that the dealer needs to pay attention to their setups and their DMS in terms of, well, I guess we'd call phase-in criteria? I mean,
absolutely.
Even for parts that are controlled by one of those three-letter words, you know, the various vendor managed inventories?
Yes, 100%. And that's one of the things we delve into is most of the OEMs have inventory management systems, which are fantastic. Yeah. We love them, wouldn't suggest anybody go away from them. But ultimately, it is the dealer's money, and it is the dealer's inventory. So you have to set up what we call, at Key, we call guardrails. You have to set guardrails up so that you have full visibility to these parts.
Okay.
And even if it is inventory managed, it still needs to be set up properly in your DMS with the right guardrails on it. Number one, for accountability purposes. But number two is visibility. That manager needs to see, and we talk a lot about, you know, 12 months being the obsolescence mark. But as a manager, once that part hits somewhere between the 7 to 12 month, the manager really needs to know what state are these parts in, because he only has a very short window to get rid of them at this point without losing money or taking restock fees or paying freight. So if they're not visible, if they're not set up properly in the DMS with stocking controls, you lose that visibility, and it makes it harder to manage.
So let me ask you one last question for me. We're talking about obsolescence, but we haven't defined obsolescence, okay? So what? At what point is it, when it stops selling, for how long, or what point? How do you, if a dealer today is listening to this podcast and he wants to pull a report off his DMS, okay, and see if he has a problem or not, if he wants to have visibility and he wants to look at it every month, okay, what defines the obsolescence, or is it defined by the dealer what he considers obsolescence?
So the industry standard, if a part has not sold in 12 months, that's considered obsolete. Now, a lot of the OEM inventory management systems, that part has to go a full 12-month cycle. So it would have to roll into the 13th month before it would be considered obsolete. That is the industry standard, that 12 to 13 mark. Now, some dealers choose to extend that out. We definitely don't recommend that because, again, now you're getting into the point where it's getting harder and harder to return those to the vendor. If a part hasn't sold within 12 months, no sales, no receiving history, nothing within 12 months, your chances of selling that part ever again are less than 5%.
So if that being said, if a part hasn't sold in 6 months, I'd probably want to start keeping an eye on it, right?
Yeah, and that's what we talked about a little bit earlier when you're looking at that 7 to 12 window.
Yeah.
You know, once it gets to about that 7th month point, that's when you really want to start thinking about, hey, what am I going to do with this part? Why is it still here? Why has it been here for 6 months and I haven't sold it? So, yeah, about that 6-7 month mark, you want to start really looking at those parts.
So are there other things in that go along with this, with obsolescence, Jeremy? I mean, you know, Mark started with the term again, frozen capital. So it seems to me like obsolescence would be just one piece of frozen capital. Certainly you've talked about the non-stock parts. If by definition they shouldn't be there because they've not met stocking criteria or stock status, would they be frozen capital if they're not over, or if they haven't hit the 1 year mark? Would you still consider them frozen capital?
Hey, absolutely. Again, just by definition, they should not be on your shelf.
Okay.
With inventory, you know, inventory is cash. So we've paid cash to get these parts here. They're non-stock. We don't have any sales history on them. They're just sitting on a shelf. So when we talk about frozen capital, there's basically three categories that make up frozen capital. Obsolete parts, parts that have gone 12, 13 months without sale. Non-stock parts, which are parts that we as a dealer have determined we don't want on our shelf. And then the last part of frozen capital is what we call excess inventory.
Okay.
And of course, there's good excess and there's bad excess. Good excess would be, I'm a dealer and I have 8 locations and I order my brake drums, my brake shoes, oil, coolant, my Freon. I order those all in bulk. I order them by the trailer load because I sell so many of them. I need to get the price. I need to move these out. But what bad excess is again, we get into the emotions. I'm a parts manager and I sold a shock to a customer. Well, there's 4 shocks on the truck if it's got a tandem rear, so I need to order 4 shocks. Again, you've only sold 1, but that manager orders 4.
Okay.
So now you've got 3 excess on the shelf.
Okay.
It's the emotional buys with the excess inventory that kill the frozen capital. And the other example that is, again, emotional, it's the manager who, these parts were on critical for 6 months. They just came off of critical. I normally sell 6 of them a year, but because I couldn't get them for almost a year, I'm going to order 50 of them because I'm never running out again. Now, you've only traditionally sold 6 of them a year, but now you've got 50 of them on a shelf.
So that's because the service manager was giving them so much heat about it, right?
Yeah, we only need an 8-9 year supply. You know?
That emotional service guy again, I tell you.
Yeah, well, service is very emotional, that's for sure.
So, I mean, you've used that term a lot. I mean, emotion, is that a regular occurrence?
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that's I really harp on it because throughout my career, again, with the parts department, a parts department is so logically driven. If you do A, B is going to fall into place. If you do A and B, C is going to fall into place. Math, fact, and logic. If you set your system up properly, if you set your stock controls, your phase in, your phase out, if you do your daily tasks, if you stay on point and do everything that you're supposed to do correctly, everything works every time.
Okay.
It's when you get emotional. It's when you make those decisions that go against the math, fact, and logic.
Okay.
It's when you think you need or you think you might. It can't happen. The parts department needs to be without emotion. Fact, math, and logic.
Wow.
So, I got one more question for you, Jeremy, along these lines, and then I'm going to turn it to Mark, see what else he has. But how does – not quite sure. There's probably more than one answer coming from you. So if you think about what you talked about in terms of emotions and the frozen capital, you said obsolescence – excess and non-stock, correct?
Those are
three. So if you've got those three under control, and you are really practicing the 5 R's, I can't remember what all you said, right? Right part, right bin, right count, those types of things. We get a lot of inquiries about, hey, are my turns where they should be? And I know we used two different terminologies for turns in terms of the financial statement turns, the gross turns, and then the true turns that measure just what's selling out of inventory. But how often, you know, best in class, you get everything in place, you got OBSO under control, you've got your stock controls, whatever we call those, correct. You've taken the emotion out of this. You know, you're using your head, you're using the logic, you're using the math to do this. What's a reasonable expectation for turns?
So for turns, for gross turns, it's at 8 turns. That is very reasonable. If you have this under control, 8 turns is not an issue at all.
Okay.
And that's gross turns now. That's how many times you're turning the actual dollar amount. True turns, how many times you're turning the actual inventory itself, would be about 6.4.
Okay.
So gross would be 8, true would be 6.4.
Okay. You have customers that do that?
Absolutely.
Okay. How do they relate to Mr. Martinsic's pet, the service department? I mean, do they have the parts that the customers need?
Well, and that's the really funny part, is watching the progression through the engagement. You know, when we first start with a customer, we do the math and we show them where they're at currently. And then we do the math and say, okay, here's your frozen capital number. Now let's do the math again, but take that frozen capital out, that obsolescence, the non-stock, the excess parts. And when we do, almost 99% of the time, that number goes above 8.
Really?
And it's great to watch the progression, because you get a lot of pushback. Because again, if I don't have it, I can't sell it, is normally the line you get from people. And they think that by quote unquote reducing the inventory, it's going to affect their ability to sell. The one customer that we were talking about earlier, they had so much obsolete inventory on their shelves that they literally had nowhere to put new fast moving inventory. They were talking about buying new buildings and expanding, and it's like, you don't have to do that. You just have to get rid of the stuff that's not moving. So once they realize that, hey, we're getting rid of, again, that frozen capital, the stuff that's not moving, the junk inventory of our shelf, and we're setting up our DMS properly with the right stock controls, so now we're getting the right parts that we need coming in, and the right parts on the shelf rather than having to order them every day. And that transformation, that's one of the best things about doing what we do, is seeing them realize how it works and seeing their eyes light up when they realize that the math, how it falls into place. And more importantly, seeing these emotional service guys get all kinds of happy because we can keep their trucks moving through the shop. That's a beautiful thing.
There you go. So, interesting. Mark, what else you got?
I just got one question. It's from a service standpoint, obviously. You talked about a lot of controls and phase in and phase out and setting up the structure and so forth. One of the things that happens sometimes from a service department standpoint, you kind of mentioned it early on, okay, and probably the easiest example, although maybe not the best, would be injectors, okay? If all of that data tells you you need to stock 3 injectors when the truck takes 6 to do the job, is there any controls you put in place? There's a number of things. I need 10 of these special bolts every time I do the job. So to me, it's one set of bolts, right, as a service manager. Is there any controls, or is that all done through just internal communications and or developing kits yourself and so forth?
No, not at all. When we talked earlier about the stock controls, that's part of the stock controls. So not only does it tell you how often you're selling this part and how many you need to stock pertaining to the number of sales, but that's also in the stock control fields, is where you set up what we call your min and max or your full bin quantities. That's where you put in per job. You know, we need 6 of these to do a job. We need a full bin of 6. So
how does a parts manager know that? Is there a history that shows it, or is that, again, through internal communication, working together? Well, I mean, we make a lot of jokes about service and parts, okay, but they need to work together. They need each other, okay? So is that through discovery and internal communication? I mean, I can't. Maybe I'm wrong, but I can't see how will your DMS system tell you that when you sell these, you always sell 10, okay? and I'm off and I'm down a rabbit hole, so I'm putting you on the spot.
Okay. It's okay.
No, it's fine because you have to have a little bit of both.
Okay.
You have to have that communication because, for instance, I'll give you this instance. Your DMS will tell you how many you sell and that every time you sell this, you sell a quantity of 10. It'll tell you that. But what it won't tell you is if it's a brand new truck, just came out.
Right.
It's going to start rolling through the shop. Maybe it's a recall. Maybe it's something that's just new on the market. That's where the communication comes in because that's where the service manager is going to get with the parts manager and say, hey, look, we just did this job. I've got six more trucks coming. You have to have 10 of these to do this job.
And my point was because there's so much finger pointing in way too many dealerships, although not as bad as it used to be between parts and service, okay, it's, I just want to encourage our listeners to work together on those kinds of things, okay?
Absolutely.
It's what it takes. If we both care about the other department, we'll all make more money and the dealer will make more money, okay? And we'll retain more customers. So those kind of things drive wedges sometimes. My computer only says that I had two hits. I didn't get three hits, but each hit was 10. And so I'm not stocking it, okay, and so forth. So those kinds of questions and taking the time to explain it to each other, except telling each other what you're doing in my department, okay, working together, finding that solution that's best for our customer and the dealership and the employees, by the way. So anyway, I'm on a soapbox. I'll get off.
No, I think it's a good point, Mark, and I think that, you know, I know as I've watched Jeremy and his team start to work, not start to work, but as they work with customers, they very much like, you know, our service team when Gil and Tom engage, it's not just about the number, right? Whatever the number is that they've looked at and dictating from that number. The number offers guidance. But I think to your point, hey, we've only sold it twice. You know, there's 10 of there's 10 every time we sell it. And that, you know, if we don't have that part, it keeps the, it's always sold to the service department. And the, every time we don't have that, or the two times we haven't had it, that it causes the tech to lose 10 hours, but the part only costs a dollar a piece, right? So, you're,
right.
So then, you know, it doesn't make sense to hold true to the, you know, to the three demands. I mean, at that point you say, maybe we should consider doing this, right? If it's a returnable part, if it's something that impacts my service department or impacts a customer, right?
Right.
I think to Jeremy's point, you know, the and your point too, the communication between the two, and not just getting emotional about it, but looking at it saying, let's look at the facts on this deal and understand what's happening. And that's the most important piece, I think, of this whole thing is learning what the system tells you, but also thinking about it critically, you know, beyond just what the system tells you.
Right. I guess that's the point I was trying to make. Okay. I just see way too much friction between the two departments way too often. And we do go out of our way, both from the service side and the parts side, work together because it benefits both departments.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about that all the time. You know, for every dollar of service you sell, it's a dollar of parts for us.
Right.
So we have to have that joint effort, that joint communication. And I know we've been on multiple service and parts engagements together.
Yeah.
And we stress so much to the client, so much to the client about how important it is to have those quick little 5-minute get-togethers with the parts and service manager, you know, while you're having a cup of coffee, you know, walk the yard, walk the shop, walk the parts department, you know, have those conversations because having that conversation up front is so much better than having it on the backside if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, that's when it's loud and emotional, when something goes wrong, right?
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So, well, I think, Keith, we ought to consider Jeremy come back and dig a little deeper sometime.
I think we should probably do that maybe next month.
Except I would buy him a shirt that he and make it mandatory that he wears it.
Yeah.
You know,
I'll tell you what, why don't we see if he can come back next month, and can you bring your cohort with you next month?
Absolutely.
I'd like to dig some further into this, and I know you guys do other things, and when I say not just inventory, I don't mean that in a derogatory way. There's other things that you guys deal with, and even in the inventory side, you talked about the terms, but you also then related to this idea of the right part on the shelf, the fill rate piece of it. I'd like to dig more into that with you as well,
okay,
Jeremy, when you come back. So,
yeah, no, I would love that.
Okay.
Great job, Jeremy.
Wrap this up for us, if you would. Just a couple of the really key things that are, you know, from an OBSO standpoint in terms of managing or frozen capital. Let's change it from OBSO to frozen capital. What is the management stuff that they should, you know, the key things they should really pay attention to?
So, again, the daily cycle counts are a key.
Okay.
Daily cycle counts, your no bin, your no cost. If your system is set up for your negative on hands, your credit memos that are run from the previous day. And one of the most important reports that I tell every client, it's a report called New Part Added. It shows you the parts that were set up in your system the day before. And every DMS has it. You know, they're all equally as good, but every one of them has it. And that single report gives you about 10 different things to look at from a management perspective that helps you stop those non-stock parts from hitting your shelf. More importantly, from being on your shelf 12 months from now. They may be there, but if you catch it on that new part added report, or if you catch it on that credit memo report, you have time to get those out of your inventory before that 30-day window that's traditionally imposed by the OEM expires.
Okay.
So those are just a couple of the reports that are on what we call, again, the daily track, the tool that we teach to. And there's so much more that goes into those reports. But those are the basic everyday, day in, day out reports that you need to look at.
Okay. So take the emotion out, get your stock control set up, know the non-stock parts, manage those OBSOs. You know, we didn't even talk about, maybe we put this on the list, Mark, for next time. You know, he talked about getting the inventory cleaned up and capturing some of that OBSO dollars back in terms of cash. We didn't even talk about how he did that.
Yeah,
we probably should explore that some more too.
Yeah, or but, pricing. How should I price?
And yeah, there's a lot of stuff. So
okay.
So
I mean, after all, it's an easy podcast to do because there's no emotions. It's all
that's bad. Right. We just kind of sit there like robots and talk to each other.
Math, fact, and logic.
Jeremy, anything else you want to leave us with? We'll come back and do this some more. I appreciate it. Anything you want to leave us with before we go?
You guys want me to get your shirts?
Well, you're going to use your shirt? Is that what you're saying? Or maybe we should get some of those with the Key Advisors logo on it.
Oh, there you go. That would be nice.
Maybe. Keith, I was wondering, you know, since Alabama does so well in football, or has, and now basketball, can we get Alabama logos that say Roll Tide on our Key Advisors shirts?
Good. If that's what you would like, Mark, you can do that. Yeah. It's a little much, isn't it, Jeremy? Just a little much. So, Jeremy, anything else before we go?
You know, I'm definitely looking forward to joining you guys again. This is a lot of fun. Can't wait to do it again.
All right. Well, Mark, Jeremy's on his way out. Anything else you want to shoot his way or ask him about?
No, I think, though, we should make a list for the next time. And maybe our viewers can send this to info@KeyAdvisors regarding the parts department next podcast or anything else.
Yeah.
Okay, put it on our list. and we'll try and do a podcast on it as quick as we can. After all, Keith and I don't have anything else to do.
That's right. We just do this all the time. So. Well, Jeremy, we'll let you go. So thanks a lot and appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Well, Mark, Jeremy's left our building. Anything you got to close us up on today?
No. I think business is good overall. Okay. I think dealers are working hard from reading all the industry rags. Trucks are exceeding the projections. Okay, both in deliveries and production. So it's and from service and a parts standpoint, that's a good thing because we can't work on those trucks or sell parts to trucks that are never sold. So
right.
Okay.
Well, I don't think I have anything in addition to that, Mark. I think that, as you said, business, our customers' business appears to be really strong still. Yeah,
very strong.
You know, and our business has been strong too. We had the best first quarter we've ever had, so we appreciate
Because we do such a great job on these podcasts.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. They learn everything that they need from an hour podcast. So, well, if Mark will hopefully, I don't think John will be back next month, but hopefully 2 months from now he'll be back and end of May maybe and join us. And who knows? We might still be talking about parts at that point too. Who knows?
But, or maybe if our clients want something else, just let us know.
Yep, okay. Absolutely. Well, Mark, thanks again. And to all of our listeners out in the internet web world, thanks for listening to us. We appreciate it very much. As Mark said, if you've got topics or things that you would like us to address, either with Jeremy for the next time he comes back or anything related to the commercial truck dealership market, we would love to hear from you. If we don't know the answer, we'll go out and see if we can find somebody. So for John Whitnell, who's on sabbatical, and Mark Martinsic, this is Keith Ely, Three Wise Truck Guys, and we're out of here.
Thanks for listening to Three Wise Truck Guys, the podcast from Key Advisors. We'd love to hear from you. Send us feedback, comments, and questions to info@keyadvisors.com.